From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll talk with Joe Cirincione, an expert on nuclear weapons policy, about the threat that the world's nuclear arsenal still poses. Then our How Did You Do That segment speaks with Justin Beck, who founded a gaming studio in Madison, Wisconsin, a place he says plays a big part in that company's success.
Two big staples of that, I think. One is, you know, the engineering talent and the Midwestern work ethic has been a phenomenal place to build out product.
And gardening expert Melinda Meyer says it's okay to be what she calls a casual composter.
I lived in the city for 26 years in a small city lot, and so I was very creative. I would do a lot of sheet composting. Annual weeds that had not gone to seeds, no seeds or flowers, I'd use as mulch around my shrubs. I'd tread my leaves with my mower and use those on the soil around my perennials.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North. The specter of nuclear destruction was unleashed at the end of the Second World War when the United States dropped two nuclear bombs on Japan. From 1945 until today, the fear of nuclear annihilation has waxed and waned, probably peaked during the height of the Cold War in the 1950s and 60s, and it lessened when the Soviet Union collapsed 30 years ago and the two superpowers seemed willing to disarm and eradicate their nuclear stockpiles. But our next guest says that while things are better, the arms race is heating up again. Joseph Cirincione is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security, nonpartisan, and nonprofit foundation that focuses on nuclear disarmament. For more than 35 years, he's been working to rid the world of nuclear weapons. He was in town earlier this month to speak at UW-Milwaukee, and he joined us in the studio then. Joe, it's great to see you again. Thanks for stopping by.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. I love Milwaukee, and it's always great to come here by the studio.
Well, we're talking about something, however, that is very serious and not fun, but so important, and that is nuclear disarmament. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, with everything going on in the world right now, is nuclear disarmament on people's minds?
It's sporadically on their minds, and I understand that. There's lots of threats. There's lots of challenges we face in the world today, and it's easy to get discouraged by that. But of all the challenges we face, there are only two that threaten destruction on a planetary scale, and that's climate change and nuclear weapons. Climate change can destroy human civilization over decades. Nuclear weapons can do it in an afternoon. So while it is not at any given point necessarily an immediate threat, it's something you have to work on, and it's something you have to be aware of, because things can go wrong very, very quickly. And we're starting to feel some of that here in the United States with the turbulence in the White House. And it reminds us that we have a system where the President of the United States has sole unfettered authority to launch a nuclear weapon anytime he wants, for whatever reason he wants. So this is something that might not be top of mind, but it is central to our continued existence.
One of the things about nuclear weapons and disarmament is I think a lot of people feel that it has been taken care of,
we
did that already. But there are still so many nations, ourselves included, that have a huge stockpile.
Yeah, right. Well, the good news is we did take care of a lot of it. And it shows that policy matters and the choices we make as a nation matter. So over the last 40 years or so, started by Ronald Reagan, really, with his Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the treaty that broke the back of the arms race, the U.S. and Russia have been steadily reducing their massive nuclear arsenals. We look back now and we realize we went nuclear nuts. At the time Reagan was negotiating this treaty with then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, there were about 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world, 70,000, and the U.S. and the Soviets had about 95% of them. So we've come down to about 14,000, so a big, big drop. Steady series of negotiations, talks, agreements, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, most of the heavy lifting done by Republican presidents, interestingly enough. But there's still 14,000 nuclear weapons, and most of these are hydrogen bombs, very, very large weapons, many times the size of the Hiroshima bomb, held by nine different nations, and the reductions have stopped. The talks about reductions have stopped. Each of these nine nations, whether it's little North Korea or big United States, are building new weapons and starting, in some cases, for us and for Russia, a new generation of weapons. So we're at an inflection point, and the decisions we make over the next couple of years will likely determine the course of the next 20 or 30, because these weapons last a long time. And if you build them now, they're going to be with you for a generation or more.
So what changed? What made that reverse?
A lot of it was politics. So, for example, when President Obama continued the Reagan series of treaties, the START Treaty, it was called, Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, when he started to renew that agreement with the Russians back in 2009 and lower the level, he brought it before the Senate for ratification. The Republicans opposed it for political reasons. They didn't want to give a Democratic president a victory in a Republican year. And it really brought the arms control process pretty much to a halt. Obama succeeded in adopting that treaty in the last day of the Senate, December 2010, but that was it. The Obama team was exhausted by the process. It required enormous political capital, and they switched to some of the other pressing issues. They did other things. They reduced the threat in other ways, but as far as reduction process, that was it. And now you get President Trump, who has an opposition to all things Obama. So you see he pulled out of his climate change accord. He tried to repeal the Health Care Act. He got out of the agreement with Iran that Obama had negotiated. And now he has Obama's new START treaty, which has an expiration date, like most treaties. It expires January 2021. Is Trump going to renew it? No, he's not. As former National Security Advisor John Bolton said, why should we renew a flawed treaty? They claim it's too weak, it didn't go far enough, but there's nothing to replace it. So here we are looking at the end of this reduction process. If this treaty is not renewed in early 2021, it will be the first time since 1972 that the Russian and U.S. arsenals have not had some kind of control over them. And when you take away the guardrails, all kinds of crazy things can happen. All kinds of crazy weapons get proposed, like that Russian nuclear-powered cruise missile that crashed a few weeks ago and in the recovery process killed seven of the technicians that were trying to bring it back. And that's when things start to spiral out of control. And that's when other countries see the U.S. and Russia racing on nuclear arms. And they go, well, we want to be part of this game, too. And they start building up their arsenals. So unless you act soon, like keep the new START treaty, get a new president that or this president that with new talks, you're going to spiral back into the Cold War arms race.
Well, and one of the things you mentioned, you're talking about talks and diplomacy. The U.S. Foreign Service is in dire straits
disarray,
right now.
In disarray, yeah.
And that really is the pointy end of the spear for all of that. Having a good, strong diplomatic corps is kind of what we need to have. And so how do you see that getting rectified?
Unfortunately, the State Department has been gutted in recent years, and this was intentional. The Trump administration saw the State Department as part of the deep state, so people who would oppose the president's wishes. So they cut the budget by 30%.
And it was never high.
It was never high.
The State Department always had the lowest budget, I think.
That's right. I mean, people think that we are lavish or generous in our foreign aid to other countries. And we're a big nation and we have global responsibilities and we do give a significant amount of aid. But it is a pittance compared to the military budget that we have. I think the entire State Department budget is about $36 billion and we spend $738 billion on the military. That just gives you some perspective here. So they cut the budget by a third, then they're slow to appoint officials, and there's been a revolving door of officials in and out of the State Department. For example, there's no longer an undersecretary for arms control and national security. There was one. She did an okay job, but she was abruptly fired last month because she wasn't sufficiently loyal to President Trump. So now we have nobody guiding these kinds of talks, these kinds of discussions, negotiations, monitoring of existing arms control treaties. It's a real problem. It's like we're trying to keep the world safe with two-thirds of the budget we used to have and half the personnel. And you can't really do that.
So what do we do? How do we change this?
Well, there's two things. I mean, I run a foundation called Plowshares Fund, and we have a saying that we support policies, not presidents. So we're not partisan. We don't pick a president and back everything they do or oppose a president and try to stop everything they do. So when it comes to President Trump, there are a couple of things that he has gotten started that we like. He has started negotiations with North Korea. Bits and starts, not very well done, not a very clear plan, but he's broken the taboo against talking to a North Korean leader. So that's something we should all be supporting. And unfortunately, I see too many Democrats kind of trying to get to the right of Donald Trump and pick on him and object to him talking to the North Korean leader, opposing the very act of diplomacy, rather than trying to help the president find the right course. That's one way you could do it. Same with Iran. We have new reports that President Trump and the president of Iran, Mr. Rouhani, came very close to reaching an agreement at the UN. Apparently, French President Macron had negotiated a four-point statement that both sides would agree to. It almost worked, but the Iranians ran into political difficulties back home. They have their own intense politics and couldn't quite arrange the phone call, couldn't quite sign it. But that, again, is a promising overture that I would hope that Democrats would support.
Talking about talking to North Korea, I was reminded, because I'm old enough to remember this, was there similar opposition to Nixon talking to China?
Nixon was very smart. He and Kissinger surprised everybody. There was no prelude. There was no exchange of love letters. You know, they just did it. Kissinger just showed up in Beijing, and then, you know, seemingly overnight, Nixon was there toasting Mao Zedong, an historic meeting. And it shows us that sometimes, you know, only a Republican can take these kinds of steps. You can imagine what would have happened if a Democrat had done that, if Jimmy Carter, for example, had done that years later. The right would have attacked him as an appeaser, as being weak. So ironically, sometimes leaders who were most opposed to our adversaries are the only ones who can make the deal with them. Because the Republican Party will trust that leader to be clear-eyed about it, the Democrats will swing in control, which is why most of the arms control agreements we've had have come from Republican leaders, whether it's China or negotiations that Reagan left or led or agreements that Nixon led or H.W. Bush. H.W. Bush is probably the biggest nuclear disarmament president in history. He got rid of 14,000 so-called tactical nuclear weapons unilaterally. No treaty, no agreement, just said we don't need these anymore and got rid, denuclearized the army, took all the nuclear weapons off the Navy surface ships back in 1991. A sweeping gesture. Only a Republican could have done that. A Democrat probably would have been impeached.
Probably. Well, and also H.W. Bush came out of the military himself and also the CIA. And
right.
He was trusted and he had a very different mean. Mm-hmm. People knew he had this background.
Yeah.
There's times when I think, the Cold War that we thought we left by. I was in the military in the early 80s and I was stationed in Europe. And that's what we were focused on, mm-hmm. of course. We were waiting for the balloon to go up or
yes.
praying that it wasn't going to, but waiting for that. And all of our missions were dedicated to preventing that or alerting if something happened. And I think, wow, you know, that this has happened again. I think what we were afraid of once that all went away was that it was going to be rogue states
right.
that would have the nuclear capabilities and do something.
And that was correct. That was a correct assessment. I happened to be in Berlin the week the wall came down in November.
30 years ago.
30 mm-hmm. years ago, right. I was just invited to the German embassy in Washington for the 30th anniversary celebration. I'm hoping to go. And there was a party going on, man. This was just unbelievable. I think I was one of the last people to walk through Checkpoint Charlie. When I went in the morning from west to east, there were guards checking my passport. When I came back in the afternoon, they were all gone, and the gates were open. And those years that followed were very, very rapid, a little confusing, a little disorienting. But what we realized was, one, we had a chance to really stand down the Cold War apparatus. And fortunately, President Reagan and President H.W. Bush took advantage of that and slashed the nuclear arsenal, slashed the budget. And they were aware that some of those materials in the former Soviet Union were now poorly guarded. surrounded by a chain link fence and no guards because they weren't getting paid. And Democrats and Republicans cooperated to pass something called the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Act. That's kind of a mouthful. But what it did was give aid to the Russians to help guard those materials, scoop them up, consolidate them, eliminate them, and prevent them from falling into terrorist hands. And guess what? It worked. There's a reason we haven't had a nuclear 9/11. It's not luck. It's not because we overestimated the threat. It's because we did something about it. But then we let everything slow down. We took our eye off the ball.
Where do you think the greatest threat is right now? Is it the heating up of tensions between Russia and the United States, or is it somewhere else? Is it India, Pakistan?
You know, every year I sort of do a rating where our greatest nuclear threats are, what are the top five threats. And while I'm very, very worried about South Asia, that is not the top threat. Last year, I awarded the top threat to the arms race, just what you pinpointed. It's this competition. And I think both sides do it for partially good reasons. They want to prevent a nuclear war, partially for material reasons. People make money off of nuclear weapons. And both in Russia and the United States, we have contractors who keep proposing new weapons, and we have leaders who approve them, and these are billions of dollars. We spend $55 billion on nuclear weapons every year in the United States and related programs. $55 billion. That's more than we spend on the State Department just for nukes. That's a lot of money. We have plans to spend almost $2 trillion over the next 25 years. That is a lot of money that could be going to other places. And while you're doing this, for good and for bad reasons, you run the risk of miscalculation, accidents, or a conventional conflict spiraling out of control and somebody popping off a nuke first. Now, we haven't done that for 74 years. It's been 74 years, and we have never again used a nuclear weapon since World War II ended. But that doesn't mean we never will. You got to be a real optimist to think you can keep 14,000 nuclear weapons in fallible human hands and something terrible won't happen. It will. So we have to take this moment that we have, this opportunity when we can't safely reduce, to reduce the numbers, change the policy, save some money, save the planet.
Are you hopeful that maybe not in our lifetimes, but at some point there will be zero?
I am. I think nuclear weapons are an historic accident. You know, we started the nuclear program, the Manhattan Project, because Albert Einstein wrote a letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt warning him that Hitler seemed to be determined to build this weapon of a new type, as he called it. The fission process had just been discovered, but they were afraid that Hitler was already onto it and had some very capable physicists in Nazi Germany. And so eventually FDR did start the program. But by the time we had built the bomb, we had already defeated the Nazis. And there was no German program, nothing of any consequence, nor a Japanese program. You know, if we hadn't started the Manhattan Project, we wouldn't have had the weapon, we wouldn't have been tempted to and then use it, and we wouldn't have ignited an arms race. Because a mere 4 years later, the Soviets match our capability, and then we're really off to the races, and that's when we go nuclear nuts and we're pumping these things out like sausages. But when you look back, you realize this is like 20th century science. You know, people built nuclear weapons listening to Glenn Miller using slide rules, you know. There's no big secret about this. And modern warfare has very little to do with nuclear. And there are some new threats, some new technologies, drones, cyber warfare, extremely fast, stealthy delivery mechanisms. And I think we can get rid of nuclear weapons the same way we've gotten rid of these other 20th century weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons. This was George H.W. Bush started a treaty called the Chemical Weapons Convention that banned chemical weapons. No major country, in fact, very few countries have chemical weapons at all. Nobody certainly brags about them the way we did. When I was in the Congress and working on professional staff of the House Armed Services Committee, there were big fights about a new generation of chemical weapons in the 80s. Gone. We no longer have biological weapons. We used to. We used to have enough toxins to kill every man, woman, and child on the planet. Richard Nixon got rid of them. Started a treaty, get rid of biological weapons. There is a treaty right now being ratified by nations in the United Nations to ban nuclear weapons the way we banned biological and chemical. It's called the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. I'm a supporter of that treaty. I think it's gaining ground. They've got 129 nations who have signed it. They need 50 to ratify it, and they're more than halfway there. So I think that treaty is going to come into law, into international law. None of the nuclear weapon states are part of it yet, but that's kind of the moral pressure and the political and diplomatic pressure you build. So yes, I think eventually we're going to realize these weapons are just too dangerous or too unusable or too expensive, and we got to get rid of them.
Joseph Cirincione is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation that focuses on nuclear disarmament. He is the author of several books on the nuclear threat, and he's also host of Press the Button, a weekly podcast from Plowshares dedicated to nuclear policy and national security. Cirincione was in town earlier this month to speak at UW-Milwaukee, and he stopped by our studio then. We'll take a short break, and then our next How Did You Do That podcast plays some games. We'll find out more on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's time now for our monthly segment on entrepreneurship.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is the executive director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keane.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angel Investors, and this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
We went around pitching kind of the idea, and it sounded like a pretty crazy idea in the moment. I mean, this is when the App Store first showed up on iPhones and smartphones, you know, was just starting to take off. And the fact that games were running on these things was not known that was going to be a tens of billions of dollar market.
When Google and Microsoft came calling with the type of jobs many young computer engineering graduates look for, Justin Beck turned them down. The 2009 graduate of UW-Madison wanted to stay in town and build the gaming studio he'd launched with his partner, Andrew Hansen.
Their first effort, a Pokemon Go-type video game, was about 10 years too early. But Justin and his partner went on to create Parallel Kingdom, a mobile, location-based, massively multiplayer game that put players in a virtual world on top of the real world. In 2016, they sold another new game, Dragon Soul, to Gree Entertainment of Japan for about $35 million.
The company today employs more than 50 developers in Madison and publishes, among other titles, Disney Heroes Battle Mode, under a partnership with the Mega Entertainment Company.
Justin, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thank you.
Hey, Justin, what made you turn down those jobs at Google and Microsoft? Why were you so interested in staying in Madison?
Well, to be honest, when someone hands you an offer and it's your first full-time offer out of college and it's a six-figure number and you come from humble roots, it's actually not that easy to just be like, But when they say, hey, you need to let us know in 2 weeks and you're in the middle of trying to build a company and trying to get a project off the ground on the floor, the answer came pretty simply. And it was like, well, you'll probably be able to hire me after this fails.
Well, we want to hear about how it didn't fail, right?
That is how we were fortunate in that way.
You started the studio in your college apartment, then moved yourselves and the studio to a house on the west side of Madison. How'd that work out?
Well, we were trying to save some money. So we stayed in apartments and rentals for as long as we could. And it actually worked out okay until in that house we got evicted. So we made one slight decision that was wrong, and that was actually to rent a house that was in a retirement community. And it turned out that everyone was watching us walk with our lunchboxes to work in the morning, and we soon got evicted. And it was a very peaceful process, and we got our first office space right around then.
That's hysterical. I love when I can turn the questions on Tim. And Tim, I want to ask you, because I know you were an investor in Justin's company, this was about the time you met Justin. Did you know about the eviction process? What was your impression of him?
Well, those are two separate questions, I suppose. I met Justin, I don't remember the month, but he showed up and said, I have this great idea for this game, and here's how it works. And I said, do you have any revenue? And he said, well, no. And I said, well, why don't you come back when you do, expecting that that would be the last time I'd ever see him. And he was back, 3 months later, saying, I think we have 600,000 customers and they're all paying us something. And we were selling, digital hats and stuff. It was fairly cool.
And were you surprised by that he came back? Does that happen a lot?
I think that entrepreneurs that can say this is what we're going to do and then do it are in the minority, which doesn't say anything about their ability to do what they're talking about, but more about their inexperience in the sales and development process and how long it really takes. So I was pretty impressed. We did have the discussion about the apartment, however, and how I thought that perhaps having 10 or 12 people working in a one-bedroom apartment might not be the world's best idea. But he knew what he was doing.
We saved a little cash.
He saved a lot of money.
Right. Well, Justin, maybe that leads to, do you want to talk about how Purblue was funded? Did it start with Tim or how did you?
Yeah, when we were initially like still in school, you know, we had very little money and we went around pitching kind of the idea and it sounded like a pretty crazy idea in the moment. I mean, this is when the App Store first showed up on iPhones and smartphones, you know, was just starting to take off. And the fact that games were running on these things was not known that was going to be a tens of billions of dollar market. And, when we first started it, you know, we needed to keep the servers on. So we had a family and friends round of, you know, a few tens of thousands of dollars that, you know, now as you go back and ask them, they basically said, well, this was kind of like a donation. It's kind of how they viewed it, that friends and family money. But after we started getting the revenue model working and we, you know, came back to Tim, I remember the second meeting we had where I was like, hey, like I shared some data tables. I was like, hey, here's our users. Here's the maybe even just some light cost of acquisition of customers there. And here's the revenue that they're paying us. We had some revenue coming in the door and then the Golden Angels led a round that was $800,000, which was our first real equity round. And just to tie that story all together with that apartment, yeah, we still were in the apartment. We moved into that West Side house after that round. And so, yeah, it's funny. We're, you know, a venture-backed company with, you know, almost, you know, $1 million in the bank. And yeah, we're sitting in this, like, really crappy apartment. And, I don't regret that. Like, we eventually got a nice office space.
I just want to jump back to something you said. When you were developing your first game, it was a mobile game that was really new at the time. How did you know that was where games were going and that you wanted to develop it?
That was one of the bets that we made that I think was right on point. I think, you know, when we saw the smartphones and what was happening with like GPS location, the screen, the touch interface, we were like, what the main question was, like, let's build some games for these things. And that turned out to be a very true trend that, by the way, is still developing. I mean, the mobile entertainment market is still growing 20% year over year in developed markets and even more than that in lesser developed markets. So that trend was one of the things where, you know, I think we were very fortunate to pick something. But in the moment, you know, it just seemed kind of goofy, like, you know, yeah, games for smartphones. It's like, well, aren't there a lot of other applications people care about more in the beginning?
Purblue is like a movie studio in a way. You live or die on the strength of the product that you put out, and you know pretty quickly how it's going to work. So where does all of that come from? How do you find the inspiration or the ideas or the content to really be successful?
Yeah, so each game we make is a content business, but it's also a service business. And I think that's one of the things that makes games fun to work on, but also just a really fascinating business. Where the ideas come from and also how do we validate them? So the ideas, it's a collaborative process within the team where we mix art vision with design ideas mixed with fantasy and story. And ultimately a set of mechanics that we think are going to be very easy to be digested on a mobile experience. And then we work the design process to turn that into a product and build it out. There's a lot of art. There's a lot of engineering in our development process. But then, like you were saying, like validating them and getting to market, that's really more of a data thing for us. So we launch our games in test markets. We capture data on how our users are playing the products. And then we use that data to evaluate whether that product is going to ultimately succeed in the market. And that's a very critical part of our process.
What was the genesis for you? Do you come at it as a computer engineer or do you play games? What got you there to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, kind of both, right? I mean, I think in my like childhood, I played a lot of games and had a certain fascination to games, as I think many youth do in our current generation of technology. But I was a software engineer, I think, first and foremost, and I liked building software. And in particular, one of the challenges when Purbu was starting was I wanted to productize my, like, contribution. Like it's one thing to be writing code and consult and do something like that, but I was really interested in making a product that we could build once and sell it a million times. And I think Purbu's construction is kind of that on, you know, now steroids, where, you know, we sell our product, you know, tens of millions of times, and we've sold, you know, many products over the last decade. So that's been fun.
So how do you manage growth as this company grows? I mean, Madison, Wisconsin isn't known as the gaming engineering center of America, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Madison has been a great home. Two big staples of that, I think. One is, you know, the engineering talent and the Midwestern work ethic has been a phenomenal place to build out product. I think on the gaming side, yeah, like the gaming hubs continue to ebb and flow through it's an international marketplace. And I think ultimately as we've grown, you know, we still recruit about 50% of our talent, but 50% of our talent is what I'll call like locally sourced. And then in the culture, you know, one of the things about operating live games as a service is that we found that our culture is one of the most important things for really onboarding talent. And so, you know, in general, and this is how it's kind of started from the beginning and it's still true today, like we hire really smart people who are really passionate about running entertainment services or making art or understanding data or building product that's really accessible. And we put them together in a team, and that's where the magic happens.
And the way you put them together in the team and the way the magic happens pretty much allows you to have the pick of the crop for talent in Madison, would you say?
I think talent acquisition now is a lot easier than it has been in the past. And I think the reason, that's not to say it's not hard, it still is always hard for any growing business to have the right team working on the right problems. But I think what's advantageous is like when you have a culture kind of initially built and you've got a great team with great attitudes and great experience, it makes it a much more appealing place for top-notch talent that wants to grow and be mentored and to exist and prosper. And I think that has been one of the most satisfying things to watch as we've gone from, you know, seven people in a college dorm room or whatever it was to 60 people now. It's watching the talent and team work together of all the different experience levels.
So, Justin, you've told us you're 32. You started this when you were 22. How do you manage that growth from a college apartment to what you are now? You're leading this thing. How do you do that at your age without the experience that a lot of CEOs have?
Yeah. So, on one hand, ignorance is a powerful tool. And I think shaping that ignorance is valuable, right? If you know what you don't know, you could do things differently, right? So, I think that's one piece. I think the second piece is I think it's very important to not let yourself get in the way of your business. And obviously every individual has talents and personality traits, and we all have quirks, we all have strengths, we all have weaknesses. I think it's been to staff around weaknesses, and it's really to take your personal strengths and to dive deep. But to be honest, I think one challenge with any, you know, young founder or young CEO is realizing when you're getting in the way of your own progress and really trying to figure out how you're going to staff with, you know, mentorship, staff with people around you or team to ultimately push through those boundaries. And I think that's kind of the main piece.
So tell us about the sale to Gree and what you might have learned from that process and if you have any tips.
Oh, lots to learn from any sale and any merger deal or whatever you want to call it. So, I mean, I think the first and foremost, I think it's a truly educational process, you know. And I think, you know, going back to the question about, like, you know, a CEO and learning when you're in your own company, it's tough to forge your way ahead and take on a big deal like that without mentorship at the board and advisor level. So, but I think some of the main big takeaways there is I think exits are hard. I think for any startup, getting a deal done, and I think where I'm probably the most proud of that deal is we found a win-win for the buyer and us that ultimately allowed us to keep the team, keep the studio, keep making new games, but then ultimately provide, you know, our investors some liquidation, provided the team some relaxation as we were running that really high revenue stream. It would have prevented us from making a lot of new games in the upcoming years at the size we were.
Justin, I just want to clarify. You said it's hard to do without mentors and advisors. What you were saying is that you had good mentors and advisors through that process, right?
Absolutely. I think in the last 10 years, I've had a wealth of mentors and advisors where I've been standing on their shoulders. And I think that's the real answer to the question is how does any young person, or I think young is kind of irrelevant. I think inexperienced is more relevant. Any inexperienced person, the best way is to take their own strengths, but then fundamentally try to take the inspiration and counsel of people around them to build on top of. And that's how you go from inexperienced to being very experienced very quickly and not have to be paying the way in every mistake.
So I got to ask, you know, given all that experience you now have, what makes a good game?
And, you know, that's a tough question, right? I think what makes a great game is having a product that pulls in an audience, that audience is like, oh, this is fun. Like, I want to keep playing this. But then the real test is that person who's just picking up and playing it also wants to continue to play it a few months later, a few years later, and they turn it into a hobby. Right, I think like fundamentally, you know, people think, oh, mobile games, whiz bang, it's kind of, but that's really not what we're doing. We provide a hobby platform for people to get together in the community, to participate in, to be able to invest in for a multi-year thing. And you know, we as a company are happy when our players are happy for a long period of time playing our products.
So Justin, you've gotten PurBlue to near 60 employees. You've got great revenue. You've got a game with Disney. What are your ambitions going forward?
Yeah, I mean, so for us, you know, we want to continue to build the best entertainment products on mobile that we can. And I think we have a real nice focus inside RPGs. And so our kind of right now, we want to be one of the best. We want to be the best, you know, RPG studio in North America is our ambition right now. I think as far as, you know, doing that, it's like we got a lot more product coming in the market, but it's really about keeping the teams humming. And
RPG is
a role-playing game, yep.
The best role-playing game studio in the market.
Yep. That's our goal. But I think in any entrepreneurial ecosystem, the markets are constantly evolving. And I think if people think of games like games now are so different than what games were even when, you know, we think of in the basement of playing on the computer. Like mobile games are just a totally different format. And I think that format is continuing to change. And what I truly get excited about is how do you provide, you know, entertainment experiences and community, you know, on mobile devices where people can play them where they're at.
Well, Justin, you've got a long career road ahead of you, so we're going to have fun watching how you shape it. Thanks so much for visiting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You can read more about this story and find links to resources by visiting WUWM.com.
And listen to all our podcasts at WUWM at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll take one last break, and then gardening expert Melinda Meyer says it's okay to be a casual composter. She explains what she means when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's almost November, and we've had some chilly overnight temperatures already. Most of us are thinking about where our snowblowers are and the shovels. We aren't thinking about gardening. But gardening expert and Lake Effect contributor Melinda Meyer says there are still things you can do, like composting. Myers is the author of several books on gardening, including Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin, and she joins us every month to talk. She tells Lake Effect's Joy Powers what we should and should not put in our compost bins.
So the things we want to compost, food scraps that are plant-based, no meat, no dairy, no bone, no fats, because that really brings in the rodents, and it's really not going to compost the same that plant-based material would be. Now, if you look out in your landscape, you want to avoid weeds that have gone to seed, because most of us don't compost hot enough to kill those weed seeds. So we make our compost and we plant weed seeds right back in. No invasive plants. Invasive plants, things like garlic, mustard, purple loosestrife, those things. The Department of Natural Resources allows you to put them in a clear plastic bag, label it invasive, and throw it in the garbage where it can be buried and won't cause a problem in the future. Perennial weeds like quackgrass and knotweed and things like that, again, we often don't compost hot enough to kill them, and so they end up surviving when we put them back into our garden or however we're going to use that compost. A friend of mine who had a great sense of humor and was a wonderful composter said, with quackgrass, burn it, spread the ashes on asphalt. He was joking, but when I share that at a talk, people look at me like, is she serious? No. But you do either need to make sure you're composting hot enough or find another way to get rid of those products.
When you say composting hot enough, what does that look like?
You know, that's a great question. So you can do casual composting. I call myself a casual composter. I throw it in a heap and wait and let it decompose. And I lived in the city for 26 years in a small city lot. And so I was very creative. I would do a lot of chic composting. What's that? Annual weeds that had not gone to seeds, no seeds or flowers, I'd use as mulch around my shrubs. I tread my leaves with my mower and use those on the soil around my perennials. And so I tried to reuse as much of my landscape trimmings as I could right in the landscape. But then what I couldn't, I'd throw in a heap and let it decompose. The more effort we put in, the faster the results, the hotter the pile will get, and the more likely it will destroy those weeds, insects, and diseases. So if we were going to compost, we'd put green materials, kitchen scraps, plant-based, fresh grass clippings, no weed killer applied, worm castings if you do worm composting, brown materials, fall leaves, corn stalks, things like that. We'd mix those together and have an 8 to 10 inch layer, a pile. Then we'd sprinkle some finished compost or soil over top because that has the microorganisms that are going to break down. Now, for me, often that's my hanging baskets that are annuals. I just dump them. I use an organic potting mix. Throw that in. There's my layer of compost. Some fertilizer, of course, I'd recommend Milwaukee's finest, Milorganite, and then another 8 to 10 inches of green and browns, and then continue this till your pile's 3 feet high at least and 3 feet wide. Let it heat up, and there are compost thermometers that you can stick down that will measure the temperature, and it'll usually spike out at 160, 165 degrees. As those temperatures cool, you move the materials in the center to the outside because that was the hottest, most decomposed, the stuff that was in the outside to the center. And then you let it heat up again, and it'll heat up, and then as it cools off, you turn. You want to keep it about the moisture of a consistency of a sponge, a damp sponge that's been wrung out. Now, if you do this, you're going to really cook those materials and get rid of a lot of the problems. And so that's a way to really manage a lot of those insect disease and weed seeds. But a lot of us are busy. A lot of us don't have compost thermometers. I always joke, I'm like, you can skip the workout at the gym. If you turn a compost pile, your obliques will get a workout, let me tell you. But a lot of us don't have time to keep up with it. One of the things I like to do is either use a dual bin composter, perfect for urban gardeners who are worried about rodents. You know, you're in the city, they're made out of heavy duty plastic. And the dual bins allow you to put all those raw materials and stockpile them, while in the other bin, you're actively composting. You've put some material, some compost, some fertilizer, you've moistened it, you've turned it regularly. So you have a place where you add new stuff constantly, but you're actively composting in the other pile. Just a hardware cloth bin that you can make, pallets, anything that holds that material in place. That's what a bin is all about, just making it easier. A double bin is cool because you can stockpile or turn an active pile from one bin to the other. And I used to say my dream was a three-bin composter. I have big dreams, can you tell? And so one could be a stockpile, one would be active, and then I'd turn it into the third pile back and forth. So I could always add new material without impacting the speed of the composting, the active compost pile.
So when we're talking about actually the heat, when these materials are decomposing, are they giving off a gas? Is that what creates the heat?
And it's the activity of the microorganisms that are working on it. So it's that activity of the decomposition. If you ever see wood chips in a pile on a cold day or even a compost pile, you'll see even steam coming out. So it's the process that the microorganisms are breaking that down.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there's, you're going to find things you can't see. You won't find those, but there are things you can't see that are very tiny. You'll see ground beetles and millipedes and centipedes and maybe even a few slugs and things like that that are helping to break those materials down, worms as well. Now, we're concerned about jumping worms, and there's been research out of University of Wisconsin that temperatures of 104 or higher will kill those jumping worms. So if you're concerned as you're making your own compost, heating it up is really helpful for that pest.
So something, if you look up composting and DIY composting
yes.
online, they'll tell you how to make a bin to compost. If you're someone who decides, like, I'm going to do this all myself, I'm going to make my own bin, what do you need to know? Because this is something, as we just talked about, it's going to heat up.
Exactly. And usually the temperature is just in the center, so you don't really have to worry. My first bin I had in the city was old pallets, and I look for heat treated pallets if, you know, because of the food issues and things. And I just used wire to hinge them together. I used one on the bottom and covered it with hardware cloth for drainage and air circulation. Because if you've got heavy clay soil, like so many people do, if you put your compost pile in a poorly drained area, it's going to get wet and soggy. And if you've ever smelled a pile of grass clippings that got wet or were in a black plastic bag, I can tell you have. It stinks, and it slows down the process. It eventually decomposes, but it's smelly and it doesn't work. You need to turn it more often. You need to add dry material.
Well, and if you have compost that starts to develop something like mold.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you need to get rid of, that you need to watch out for?
It's just a good clue that something's off balance. It probably means you have too much water in there. Or maybe if you're using a lot of wood products, break down slowly. So if you have twigs and branches, a good place for those is at the bottom of your compost pile. So they act for, you know, they provide that air and drainage that my pallet did. They're going to be there for a long time, but at least you're going to turn the pile over top. Adding dry material is a good way to kind of combat that. And then just, you know, if we're having a rainy period like we did this summer, you might even consider throwing a cover on it or just a piece of plastic if it looks like it's going to rain forever and things are staying wet. Tarping it temporarily is a good way, too, to help, you know, keep that moisture level at the right place.
So how do you know when your compost is good to go?
You know, great question. I get that all the time. If it looks like soil, basically, and crumbly and brown, it's finished. If you use partially decomposed compost in your garden, it will continue composting. The microorganisms that work on the decomposition can temporarily tie up the nitrogen in the soil. So partially decomposed compost, good addition in the fall garden because it'll break down over winter. Otherwise, if you can wait till it's totally decomposed, you'll get the biggest benefit. And things you can do with it, I get that question. Grate in containers, add it to your potting mix. Sprinkle it on the soil surface of your lawn. If you core aerate, it works great. Fresh Coast Guardians gives you some ideas with that. And then one thing that they recommend as well on their website, freshcoastguardians.com, is that they'll, you know, when you're starting a new garden, don't want to use chemicals. Put down newspaper or cardboard and sprinkle the compost. Plant your native plant seeds in there. They'll sprout and eventually root through that newspaper or cardboard. The newspaper and cardboard create an organic barrier between your weeds and grass so that those natives get a faster start. So I thought, well, that's another cool way I've got to try to use my compost.
Yeah. Well, Melinda Myers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your tips.
Thank you, and I hope everyone gets out and gets busy composting. Put it in a heap. It will eventually decompose.
Melinda Myers is the author of several books on gardening, and she's a regular contributor to Lake Effect. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find more of our conversations with her at WUWM.com. We have time today for a little music to finish up the show. Here's Milwaukee's own Peter Mulvey, recorded in our studio earlier this year. The song is called Who's Going to Love You?
When this bird has flown, when spring has sprung, when what you used to know, like the back of your hand, isn't even on the tip of your tongue,
when the chips have settled, when the dust is down, when you've washed off the grease paint and you're still a clown. Who's gonna love you? Who's gonna love you now? Who's gonna love you? Who's gonna love you now? When the bottle is empty, when the money is gone, when you are just another angry old man shouting, get off my lawn. When your tree has fallen and there was no one to hear it, when your heart is a cornered stray and you can't get near it, who's gonna love you? Who's gonna love you now? Who's gonna love you? Who's gonna love you now? Every bottom dollar has gone to the last top dog. When the princess has kissed you soundly and you are still a frog. When there's no way through, when the only way is out. When it is all over but the shouting and you're too tired to shout. Tell me who's gonna love you? Who's gonna love you now? Who's gonna love you? Who's gonna love you? Who's gonna love you now? Now.
Singer-songwriter Peter Mulvey recorded earlier this year by WUWM's Jason Reavy in Lake Effect's performance studio. The song was called Who's Going to Love You? You can find our complete interview with Peter at WUWM.com. And that is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.